The following episode may contain inappropriate material. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, this is Bruce Valanche. Remember on Hollywood Squares, the guy to the left of Whoopi, if that's possible? I'm listening to John Orlando on the PVD cast.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another installment of the PVD cast. I am your humble host and your podcast purveyor, John Orlando, and welcome to episode number 271. I hope you're doing well out there. If you're anything like some of the residents here in Ohio, you might be digging out from a series of snowstorms. You know, it was funny that I mentioned on the last episode that I don't mind winter, and then it seemed that we got stuck in this cycle here in central Ohio of snow, then a day off, then snow, then a day off. It's been really kind of a crazy week here in terms of the weather. But you know what? That's how Mother Nature is. She is one fickle mistress. I do want to talk about one thing real quickly before I talk about my guest. And that is I got an opportunity this week to sit down and teach somebody how to podcast. I think I've said it many times before on the PVD cast, I really enjoy helping out others, whether it's somebody that's just starting a podcast or if it's somebody that's been doing it for a while that needs some help or needs some advice. I love the camaraderie of podcasting, I guess, is my first point. And my second point is, as this individual had stated, I just got to do it, right? Yeah, you just got to go and do it. And that actually is applicable to any hobby or any goal or any objective. Just do it, man. Learn from your mistakes, move on, get better every time that you do a podcast episode or you play that video game or you take up that new sport, whatever it is, just do it. You know, that's the only way you're going to know if you can succeed or if you're going to fail. So with that, I don't have a snappy transition into talking about my guest. I really don't. So let's just keep it simple. And I'm going to tell you that Steve Rubin is joining me on this episode of the PVD cast. He is a creator of two really interesting encyclopedias, one covering everything James Bond and the other talking about the Twilight Zone. And I had a blast having Steve come on and talk about these two encyclopedias. As a matter of fact, as I mentioned in our conversation, Steve was nice enough to send over a digital copy of both those encyclopedias, and they're awesome. They really are. So we're going to talk all things Twilight Zone and all things James Bond. I learned some cool things, and hopefully you will too, as we discuss these two icons of American television and movies. But before we get into that, I need to let you know that this episode is brought to you by the great sponsor, World's Greatest Comics. They're located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. And they have tons of comics, graphic novels, toys, comic book supplies, collectibles, back issues, posters. They got everything you need for your comic book fandom. So stop on over to the store and say hi to Jeff and the fine folks at World's Greatest Comics. But if you're not in the Central Ohio area, you can still check them out. Just go over to the internet and look at wgcomics.com, which is their great website, or you can even find them on Facebook. Just search for at wgcomics. And if you interact with anybody from the store, whether in person or online, please let them know that you heard about the store from me right here on the PVD cast. So I'm going to throw it to a quick break, and on the other side of the break, I'm going to talk about James Bond and the Twilight Zone with my guest, Steve Rubin. Ladies and gentlemen, joining me this evening is Mr. Steve Rubin, the creator, the man behind a James Bond encyclopedia and a Twilight Zone encyclopedia that a fan of either one of those shows or movies, definitely needs to check it out. Steve, how are you doing?
I'm great, John. Thank you. It's kind of quiet out here in Southern California. Hopefully the calm before the calm. We've had enough storm.
I was going to ask, because I unfortunately asked this to every one of my guests, how are things in terms of the coronavirus out there in Southern California?
It's pretty awful, actually. Although, as I mentioned earlier before the broadcast, I booked my vaccine, so that's exciting. It's not been good. We're just making do every day. My social event of the week is going to the market. That's about it. And it's not good. It's not good. But I think with these vaccines coming, I think I see the clouds parting and getting some blue sky soon.
Mm-hmm. And hey, you know, that's all you can hope for. I mean, that it's been a rough year, and I agree with you. I think maybe there's some light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, certainly for the James Bond producers, you know, they want to get this new movie out there, and I am hoping that we'll see it this year. Currently, it's booked for April, but all rumors now are flying that it's heading into November again. So it'll be nearly 7 years since the last James Bond movie. I mean, you know, the last Bond movie, Spectre, was released in 15. So it's over 6 years now, and if it's not till November, it'll be close to seven.
Well, you know what? Let's talk about just some general notes about both of these projects, and then we'll dive a little deeper into Bond and the Twilight Zone. So, Steve, why did you decide to create these books?
Well, my interest in James Bond movies goes way back. I mean, I'm a child of the 60s. I always talk about my dad coming home from business trips and always seemed to like reading Westerns. And I had no interest in reading Westerns. But one day, I think it was just before my 13th birthday, he came into my room and dropped a paperback called Goldfinger on my desk. And I was 12 years old. It had a picture of a naked woman on the cover. She was tastefully covered in gold, of course, and in all the right spots. And I said, what is that? And I started reading my first James Bond novel by Ian Fleming. And at that time in junior high school, we called them junior highs in those days, not middle school. Every guy in my class seemed to have one of the colorful paperbacks on his desk. And it was a Signet had brought out the Bond novels in paperback form. And that Christmas, we went to see Goldfinger. That was the big movie. It was like the Avengers, Spider-Man, whatever movie of the year. And since we had all read the books, this was a big event. Now, interesting, we didn't realize that this was the third James Bond movie. Dr. No and From Russia With Love had already come out, and we hadn't seen them. Interestingly, after the success of Goldfinger, they were re-released as a double feature and did a lot of business because people had missed them. But this was the time of Bond fever, and I was just having so much fun with those movies. Certainly with going through puberty, the James Bond movies had a very dramatic effect on all of us as guys. So when I started to write after college, I went through a whole process. My first book was on World War II movies. It was called Combat Films, American Realism, 1945 to 1970. And I went around Hollywood and interviewed filmmakers for about 2 years and put together an anthology of great stories about behind-the-scenes filmmaking. And this coincided with my work at a magazine in Chicago called Cine Fantastique. And my work there kind of led me to figure out what I wanted to write about that had a bigger audience. I mean, writing about World War II combat films and science fiction films is one thing, but James Bond, there was no behind-the-scenes history at that time. So I started to do the research. I'd been a fan of John Brosnan's book. The very first book written about the James Bond films was called The James Bond and the Cinema by John Brosnan, which is mostly an homage to the series, kind of just talking about the plots, not a lot of behind-the-scenes information. And having wet my beak and doing great film research, I thought the Bond films would be ripe for it. And I hit Cubby Broccoli up at the right time. I think he respected me as an historian. And I went over to London that summer of 77, and I got a lot of interviews done. I was one of the first journalists to do serious research into the making of the James Bond movies. And that produced my first book, which was called The James Bond Films, A Behind-the-Scenes History, which was published in 81. And then 9 years later, I was approached by Contemporary Books of Chicago, which had had success with a Marilyn Monroe and Elvis Presley encyclopedia. They asked me if I could do a James Bond movie encyclopedia, and I had a lot of fun with it. Yeah, the concept was actually fun. Putting an encyclopedia together is fun because it's gathering all sorts of entries from all different places. And I really wanted to tout the performers, not just the Sean Connerys and the Ursula Andresses, but a lot of the secondary actors telling you a little bit about where they came from and who they had worked with before. And then just categorizing all the fun stuff, the villains, the girls, the gadgets, the locations, trivia, famous quotes. It's a celebration book. It's really all about what we love about James Bond with a lot of hard research behind it.
I did not anticipate you saying it would be fun, because to me, that seems daunting. And don't get me wrong. I mean, I as a big fan of whatever you are a big fan of, whether it's Deadpool and comic books or whatever, I would still think it would be daunting to put together an encyclopedia. So for you to say it's fun, that's totally not what I expected, Steve.
Well, it's fun, but it is a lot of work, particularly when it comes to finding the photographs, because, you know, I think I'm a good writer. I think I have kind of a punchy style, but I think when people open up a James Bond movie encyclopedia, they want to see really cool photographs, and not just the typical stills from that you've seen, but something a little new and fresh. So I had to conduct a international search, and because the Bond movies are so treasured by so many people, there are collectors out there who've collected the photographs over the years. So I went to the various photo archives around the world. I physically went over to Europe last year in 19, and I went, it's almost 2 years now. I went over there to Sweden. I went to France. I went to England. And then I have friends in other parts of the world who gave me photographs. I have one friend down in Argentina. And I also got great art from two wonderful artists, Jeff Marshall and Brian May, gave me their representations of their version of the posters of the James Bond movie. So I have some really unique photos and artwork in the book. And this is my first book with color. This is my sixth James Bond book. It's the first time I've been given the opportunity to present color images.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you had mentioned this is the fourth edition, the newest one that's just came out. But you've done three other kind of editions of the encyclopedia. Were you just updating it with the new information and the new trivia and that came out, like when the Daniel Craig films come out? I assume that you just have to update them every so often.
Right. The last edition of my book was 2003. So I completely had to update it through all the Daniel Craigs. And fortunately, I was able to get some information and some good images from No Time to Die, even though none of us have seen it. It was a little frustrating because I was all set to see the movie in April because I really wanted to chronicle in the book to length. And then, of course, they pushed it. And I'll tell you, of all the movies, they've kept their plot really under wraps. It has not leaked out. And I know some elements of it are interesting, but this is really they've done an MI6 campaign to keep it quiet.
Which is hard to do nowadays. It's very hard to do. It's not like back when, back in the 80s and the 70s and that, where you could keep a lid on it with social media, man. It leaks out like that.
Right. No, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, it's funny because every time I would hear something, I would call friends and ask them what they heard, and they didn't hear anything. And usually somebody's seen it already in one of the previews and could sneak you some details. That happened with me in one of my earlier books. I think it was GoldenEye. I actually was able to talk to one of my friends who had seen the movie, and he corroborated some of the plot details. I don't like to give away spoilers if I can avoid it. And I certainly haven't given away anything really substantive for this new movie. So if you pick up my book today, you're not going to be spoiled.
Well, let's talk some more about Bond real quick. I'd like to get your opinion on a couple of topics relating to James Bond. Let's start with, what is your favorite Bond movie?
Good question. it's interesting. It's now 57 years since almost 57 years since I've seen Goldfinger. And Goldfinger still remains my favorite. But I have to say that the first Daniel Craig, Casino Royale, just blew my socks off. I thought that Daniel Craig's Bond, the whole way Martin Campbell directed that movie starting from the very beginning, was just jaw-dropping. And we were very disparaging of Daniel when we first got announced as Bond. He was kind of referred to as the blonde Bond, give me a break. And he just is off the charts great. And even though the four films he's done have not all been great, I would say two of them are in the great quality. I think Casino Royale and Skyfall are terrific. It's just, he's so terrific. And I think he's reinvigorated the series to another level.
I agree with you. I think Casino Royale, to me, is my favorite. But I also put right up there From Russia with Love, because that was the first one I saw as a teenager.
Okay.
You know, on the old UHF station, you know, you had to, you know, Channel 53 or whatever was shown at one, I don't know, Saturday afternoon or Sunday afternoon. And so that one's got a special place in my heart as well.
That would be in my top five. I would say okay. That Dr. No, From Russia with Love, and Thunderball are all there in my top five. And Honor Majesty's Secret Service, the one that George Lazenby did, that's also right up there. It kind of gets knocked for Lazenby, the non-actor who did one. But if you really analyze that movie from top to bottom, it is a beautifully produced James Bond movie, very close to Ian Fleming's novel.
Mm-hmm. You know, I still remember, too, as a teenager, Red Grant was just such an amazing character in From Russia with Love. You know, of course, played by the great Robert Shaw, but it still leaves an impression on me today.
You may know the right wines, but you're the one on your knees. How does it feel, old man?
Moving on into like something that you had just mentioned about just a few moments ago about Daniel Craig reinvigorating the Bond franchise. I remember a few years ago that I read something very, very interesting. It was when MGM was having a lot of financial issues. And the article was about how they lost a lot of their franchise films because they sold them off, maybe in a panic to make money or out of ignorance. I don't recall when. And they kind of outlined that Bond was the last franchise MGM had and that it was kind of touch and go to see if indeed at this point, I think Casino Royale was the only thing that was out for Daniel Craig, but it was still touch and go as to the future of Bond. What did you think in terms of after that first movie? Did you have concerns? Have you heard these stories about MGM maybe selling off the franchise? What are your thoughts on that whole mess, so to speak?
You know, MGM has been a troubled company for many years. I mean, going back to, boy, I'll tell you, I remember going back all the way to the early 80s when they were going through a period, they had a really terrible period, I think, after the release of License to Kill in 89, yeah. Because the company was actually purchased by an Italian financier who kind of ran it into the ground. Mm-hmm. And that's mm-hmm. why we had a long gap between License to Kill and GoldenEye. I think it was about 5 or 6 years. And that was difficult. Unlike the other studios, like the Warner Brothers, Universal, Disney, Sony, MGM hasn't had the multiple streams of income they've had. It's not attached to a TV network or a theme park. It's really a company that's really makes its revenue mostly on its television shows and feature films. And they've never been able to ramp up a ton of product. I think even their TV division has done better than their movie division. So they're kind of a company that's been in various stages of duress. And now, of course, here we are in 2021, where there's rumors flying that MGM is going to finally be sold. And I'm hoping that the company that buys it maintains the whole MGM mythos, you know, the logo and the lion, because, you know, 20th Century Fox was recently bought by Disney. And I think 20th Century Fox is going the way of the dodo. I don't think that Fox logo is going to be around much longer. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful. Mm-hmm. The Bond franchise is a huge value. I think that any company that buys MGM, they're only buying half the franchise because the other half is owned by the Broccoli family. And MGM purchased the other share of Bond from Harry Saltzman back in the mid-70s. That's when Harry Saltzman got into some financial trouble and had to sell off his share of the bonds.
Mm-hmm. You know, one other thing that I read in that article too that I remember, the Broccoli family was mentioned, is they're not really, how do I want to say it? They're kind of outsiders to Hollywood, because they're not always in Hollywood pitching ideas. They do Bond films. That's what they do. They're not constantly in LA going, let's do a romantic comedy, let's do this project, that let's do that project. And the article mentioned that maybe that was some of the problems within dealing with the idea of whether we should sell off Bond or not, is because, you know, if you're not there to defend, you know, the reason why MGM, you need to keep Bond, it's real easy to go, you know what, we're just going to sell this off. What do you think about that?
Barbara Broccoli, who's basically taken over for her father along with her stepbrother, Michael Wilson, have been producing the Bond steadily, but I think Barbara is ambitious. I think she wants to do other things. She has made some other films of late. I don't think anything as near as successful as Bond, but I think she's ambitious to do other things. We're all wondering if the Broccoli family will finally sell out. I mean, do they want to keep making the Bond films? Do people in their family want to keep making the Bond films? We don't know. I'll tell you one thing. As soon as they sell off, I'm going to put in my chit to see if I can write one. It would be fun. Because I make my daily effort these days is just screenwriting. I've been writing now for about 20 years, and I'm out there every day trying to sell film and television shows as a producer. And I would love to tackle a Bond film. It would be a dream come true.
Well, I think many people consider Sean Connery to be the very best Bond. Do you feel that some of the other actors that played that role, do you think they get a bad rap?
Well, first of all, you usually love the Bond you grow up with. So I've talked to many fans who grew up with Roger Moore, some fans who've grown up with Pierce Brosnan, and now, of course, Daniel Craig. Every Bond has kind of carved out their own little niche. Even George Lazenby, who did The One, I think there's a huge fan club for his One movie. You know, he should have done more, but he was given some what I would consider horrible advice by his agent at that time, who said basically that Bond was over. I mean, in the mid-60s, in the middle of the mod dress and all of the counterculture, a secret agent in a business suit was considered a little bit out of favor for him, at least. And so George took his advice and walked. He was offered a contract to do more Bond films and mm-hmm. walked. So that was tragic. And Roger Moore sometimes gets knocked a little bit for more of a comic approach to the character, a little more lighthearted. And if you can say that, but Roger's movies in the 70s and 80s brought a whole new generation of Bond fans to the party, and the size of the movies increased exponentially. I mean, a movie like The Spy Who Loved Me pulled out all the stops. It was a big international adventure film, as was Moonraker, which went into outer space, and then Octopussy. I think the Moore films got bigger and bigger and bigger, and their success was very, very, very big. Timothy Dalton's movies, I don't think, are as in favor. There are Dalton fans out there. Personally, I think he's a terrific actor. I just don't think he had the panache to be James Bond. I think there was just something missing. Pierce Brosnan should have been much more of a success. I think his movies did well, although they weren't written as well as the current Daniel Craig's. I think my favorite of the Pierce Brosnan's is The World Is Not Enough with Sophie Marceau and Denise Richards. And I thought GoldenEye was pretty good. But the Daniel Craig movies seem to have caught the favor of the fans more than any of the recent Bonds.
So who would you cast if you had a chance to cast somebody for James Bond?
Very good question. Very good question. It's funny. I'm a big fan of a British television series called Strike Back. I don't know if you've checked it out. It's on Cinemax.
Okay. No, I have not.
The two actors, Strike Back, for the listeners who've not heard of the show, is a British action series, kind of like Mission Impossible on a weekly basis. It's the operations they get involved with are really violent and crazy. But these two guys who play the leads, and one of them is an Australian actor named Sullivan Stapleton. He would make a great James Bond, but I don't know if he's you know, in their on their radar at the moment. My wife likes the actor in the show Outlander, Sam Heughan or whatever his last name.
Yes. Yes. You know,
whenever he takes his shirt off, she swoons a little bit. I like him as an actor. Idris Elba's name has come up several times as an African American James Bond. I can't call Idris Elba an African American because he's a Brit. So, but anyway, he'd be good. He'd be interesting. The rumors are flying that
Henry Cavill?
Yeah, Henry Cavill, Superman, is in the running. Kind of a safe choice. He's already got a reputation as being popular with fans. It'll be interesting to see. I kind of hope they find somebody new, because when you bring in a new Bond, it kind of gives it a certain mystery, which I think the series needs.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder what happens to Daniel Craig. You know, he's done. He moves on. I'm curious to see what his very first project will be right after Bond. I mean, that's got to be in everybody's mind. Here's the guy that, let's be honest, I mean, prior to Bond, I can only name one other film he was in, Layer Cake, in which he was kind of a British mobster film. You know, so he's still got plenty of miles left. You know what I mean? So it'll be interesting to see what he does.
He got some attention recently for that movie Knives Out.
Yes, that's right. He was in Knives Out, which was really well done.
Quite a Southern detective. That was kind of a funny role. And I think that he's a good actor. He's just fun to watch. And I think that his Bond has been, I mean, he's really put his heart and soul in that role. And a lot of physicality. He's been beat up a lot. He's hurt himself. A broken ankle, I think, on this last movie. I mean, this is a guy who pours himself into the role, and it shows. It really shows. Mm-hmm. And even in a movie like Quantum of Solace, I'm not a big fan of Quantum of Solace. I just thought it was kind of a bland Bond film with a bland villain. He's great. You know, whenever he's on screen, just like with Sean Connery, whenever they're on screen, it works. And, you know, Sean did the last James Bond movie Sean did was a remake of Thunderballs called Never Say Never Again, you know. And I thought the movie was kind of flat, but he was great.
And I agree with you. I feel like Quantum of Solace is not my favorite, nor is You Only Live Twice. I was not a big fan. That one just, it's like a mess. It's a muddled mess. There's like no clear, besides that you see Blofeld for the first time. That's the only big deal out of it. It's like kind of, I don't know, it's hokey. I just didn't dig it.
I always look at the helicopter chase as part of the problem with that movie. It's like James Bond, robot, kill copter. Oh, there's another one. James Bond, kill copter. Oh, there's another one. James. It's not the most exciting thing in the world. And it's tragic because Peter Hunt told me that the guy who was photographing the helicopter chase, You Only Live Twice, was caught in an updraft, and one of the camera helicopters slammed into his helicopter and chopped off his foot. So he's filming the action in that helicopter chase, and his foot is falling to the ground. I mean, it's just incredible. His name was Johnny Jordan. He managed to put a prosthetic on that foot. And he ends up directing the bobsled skiing scenes in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And pretty crazy.
That is a crazy story. I'm going to interrupt my conversation with Steve for just one moment to talk to you about World's Greatest Comics. It's the one-stop shop for all your comic book-related needs. They've got single issues, graphic novels, collections, toys, collectibles, back issues, posters, comic book supplies. They've got it all. And if you want to make sure you never miss a single issue of your favorite comic, sign up for their pull system, and every time the book comes into the store, they'll hold a copy for you at the register till you come by and pick it up. If you're in the Central Ohio area, just swing on by the store. They're located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio, or you could check them out online. WGComics.com is their website, and they're even on Facebook. Just look for @WGComics. And if you stop by World's Greatest Comics, let them know that you heard about the store from me, John Orlando, on the PVD cast. Well, let's shift gears to the Twilight Zone, all right? Why did you decide to make the encyclopedia for the Twilight Zone?
Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, I'm out there every day trying to sell films and television shows in Hollywood, and it takes forever. I mean, literally decades could go by before you can get a sale. So what do you do as a writer while you're trying to sell films and TV shows? Well, I decided to get back into writing history because that was my passion. And as a Twilight Zone fan, everyone is familiar with Mark Sucre's book from 1982, The Twilight Zone Companion. It's kind of the first book written on the Twilight Zone, kind of like with my first James Bond book. But I thought, having done the James Bond Encyclopedia, I thought I could apply the same format to the original Twilight Zone. My book, by the way, only covers the original black and whites. This is the 1959 to 1964 series. And once again, I wanted to kind of give life to all the performers who appeared in those 156 episodes. So it gave me an opportunity to shine the light on people who often don't get the light shined on them. And also, I just wanted to find as much behind the scenes information as possible and really present it as again, a fun book that if you watch an episode like Time Enough at Last with Burgess Meredith with the glasses, you can learn a little bit about the episode and who was in it, and then you can learn more about the people who was in it. And I've got great response from it. It's been a fun, and then I was able to collect some great photos thanks to my relationship with Carol Serling, who was Rod's widow. Sadly, she passed away last year, but she was my conduit. Not only did she give me access to a lot of great photographs, but she opened her files and I saw the original contracts with the performers. So I could tell you on most of the cases how much the performers made. And it's kind of shocking because you think of these iconic episodes and, the top of show, the person who made the most money on a Twilight Zone made $5,000, which seems so pitiful today, but that was top of show back then. And then a character actor who took a smaller part, but not a less memorable part, might make $800 for being in a Twilight Zone.
That was the thing that surprised me when I was thumbing through the encyclopedia. I stopped to just check out a couple of, I like Claude Aiken, who'd been in a couple of episodes, including my favorite, Monsters of Doom on Maple Street. And so I was checking that out, and to see, like, I think he made, what, $1,500 for his appearance. Adjust for inflation, that's still kind of not what I expected. You know what I mean? Even if you adjust for inflation to today's dollar amount.
Yeah. And these guys would come in for 3 or 4 days. I mean, it wasn't a long shoot. And I have to say something about the black and white photography. There's just something that I believe that they capture like lightning in a bottle by shooting these episodes in black and white. They give it an otherworldly quality from the beginning. That's why it's very hard to replicate the success of The Twilight Zone with color. And obviously Jordan Peele has brought the series out again on CBS Access, and they did two previous reincarnations of the show. But I'll tell you that when you put a Twilight Zone in color, you lose half your atmosphere right off the top of your bat. Mm-hmm. And I think, especially if you buy the Blu-ray sets these days, the sharpness of those George Clemens photographed images are just off the charts.
If I recall correctly, did they not switch the format in one season where they shot, instead of using film, they shot a different manner? I want to say use tape, or is that incorrect?
No, you're absolutely right. Second season, James Aubrey, the head of MGM programming, who was a bit of a nemesis to Rod. He did not like Anthology. In fact, he spent most of his time canceling Anthology series. He canceled Playhouse 90, the very honored series from the 50s. And he did not want the zone, but Rod had a very ironclad contract. And as long as he had decent ratings, he was going to stay on. But they wanted to cut the budgets. I guess the filming was expensive. So in the second season, I believe 6 episodes were shot on videotape, including the Art Carney episode, Night of the Meek, which is the Santa Claus episode, and the Billy Mumy episode about the telephone long-distance call, and 22, the episode about the lady who goes down to the morgue in the hospital, those kinds of episodes. There were 6 of them, and they were shot on tape, and they don't look very good today. I mean, mm-hmm. You compare them to the sharpness of the film image, there's just no comparison.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask your opinion on this here. The Twilight Zone was a launching pad for many, many actors and actresses. Shatner, Julie Newmar early on was in an episode, Dennis Hopper, et cetera, et cetera. Was that just coincidence, or did Rod really have a very good eye for talent?
That's a good question. I think that the casting of the Twilight Zone may have been the best casting ever in the history of television. I think they got the best of the best. I think the show right off the bat got a great reputation in Hollywood. And I think people wanted to be in zones. I think they had a good eye for talent. And for instance, Robert Redford, who had already Redford had been in one of Rod's live television shows from New York. He was on the radar. But I think they just had great casting people. I mean, this is MGM at the height of MGM. I mean, basically, they still had a lot of people under contract. It was starting to fade. I mean, this was the beginning of the end of the contract system, as well as the back lot. I mean, shortly after the show finished, you know, just a few years later, they tore down the whole back lot, which was unfortunate. But MGM's casting people, the producers, Rod himself, they had a great eye for casting. So they found the best of the best. One thing about The Twilight Zone, you may not like the 156 episodes. Certain ones maybe don't fly, but the actors were always terrific.
What was the most surprising fact that you didn't know while you were compiling this encyclopedia on The Twilight Zone?
That's a very good question. I think that I was very curious about how successful the show was, because mm-hmm. over the years I'd heard rumors that it was very tough to keep it on the air, because not only was James Aubrey breathing down their neck, but their ratings were not great. And in going through the varieties and the reporters in terms of how well the show was doing, it was not doing that well. It very seldom broke into the top 25 shows. And that was part of the problem. They had trouble keeping it on the air. I think that Aubrey's theory, and it's probably correct, is that people watch television series based on the performers. In those days, they watched The Untouchables because they wanted Robert Stack. They watched Gunsmoke because they wanted James Arness. They watched I Love Lucy because they wanted Lucille Ball. So he felt that the reason he didn't like anthology is because they had to reinvent the wheel each week, and it was hard to promote that. You can't say, you know, The Twilight's coming on with, you know, William Shatner every week, because they didn't have William Shatner every week. So I think that, you know, the anthology numbers were not great. I think part of the reason that Rod went from kind of narrating the first season audio-wise to actually being on camera visually was for that very reason. They wanted to have somebody who was the weekly icon of the show, kind of like what Alfred Hitchcock was doing on his show. Alfred Hitchcock obviously had the same kind of show, anthology, which was more thriller-oriented, but it was the Alfred Hitchcock show. And Twilight Zone, in many ways, was the Rod Serling show.
What's your favorite episode of The Twilight Zone?
That's a really tough question, because if you go through, there are probably 25 episodes I consider five out of five-star episodes. And I have a tendency... Certainly the Burgess Meredith episode, Time Enough at Last, is one of my favorites just because of just what it is. But I also like the nostalgia of the two first season episodes, Walking Distance with Gig.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's just a beautifully written episode. And then also its companion episode, same kind of type of story, is A Stop at Willoughby with... James Daly playing the harried advertising executive taking the train to Hartford. Those are two very special episodes for me, but there are so many others. I mean, The Howling Man, which was directed by Doug Hayes, who also directed Eye of the Beholder, both mm-hmm. very artistic episodes. He also directed The Invaders, which was, of course, the basically silent Agnes Moorehead episode. And then anything associated with airplanes I'm into. So Shatner on the Airplane and Nightmare on 20,000 Feet, Odyssey of Flight 33 when the airliner goes back in time. And then even The Last Flight, which was a Richard Matheson episode about the World War One flyer who lands at a modern jet base. Those are really cool episodes.
So you are a fan of airplanes and aviation?
I am. I'm a big aviation fan. Absolutely.
Okay. Did that start off when you were a kid as well?
Oh, yeah. I made all the little airplanes with the model airplanes. And I think one of the first seminal movies that really knocked my socks off was a Robert Mitchum, Robert Wagner Korean War film called The Hunters, 1958. It's one of the few films that kind of showcases the F-86 Sabre jet, which was our mainstay fighter in Korea. So, yeah, I like plane stuff. It's fun.
Ever think about becoming a pilot?
Not on your life. I think the original title of Secret Agent Man, the Patrick McGoohan series, was Danger Man. Well, mm-hmm. If I was ever to have my own series, it was No Danger Man. Thank you.
Well, Steve, let's wrap things up here real quick. Let folks know where they can get in touch with you. Website, social medias, where they can pick up the books, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, well, the James Bond Movie Encyclopedia is all over the place right now. If anybody wants a signed copy, they should get in touch with Larry Edmonds Movie Bookshop in Hollywood. It's larryedmonds.com, and that's E-D-M-U-N-D-S. They're a very famous Hollywood bookshop, and if you order the book there, I go in and I sign the books, and the books are shipped directly to people wherever they are. And they do that also for the Twilight Zone Encyclopedia. Both books are available on Amazon and bookshops in your neighborhood if you're visiting bookshops. Hopefully they're still around. I have social media presence. I have two Facebook sites. One is just Steve Rubin, R-U-B-I-N. And then I have the James Bond Movie Encyclopedia as a page. And I have the Twilight Zone Encyclopedia as a page. I'm also on Instagram, Steve Rubin, R-U-B-I-N, and LinkedIn, Steve Rubin, R-U-B-I-N.
You know, just I had a question just pop in my head. You mentioned about, that wonderful bookstore sending out autographed copies. Have you got feedback from some fans that have purchased the book?
Yes. I keep an eye on the Amazon reviews particularly. Everybody's loved it. They really have. I think that, I have to say this. It's if you own my previous encyclopedias, they were a lot larger in size. This is a little bit more of a compact size. It's still very heavy. I think one of the regrets is some people have said that they wish it was in hardcover, and I wish it was too, but the dynamics of price points for book publishing these days have changed dramatically. But it's a very pretty paperback. I guess I can show it to you. Do you want me to just lift up a cover? Would you like to see it? But sure. Then again, this is on audio, so it doesn't matter.
Audio.
Never mind. But if you go on Amazon, you'll see the book in all its glory.
Yeah, and you know what? I'll tell the listeners right now, you were so gracious enough to send me a digital copy of both of these books, and they are gorgeous. They are really, really pretty. They're well laid out. As I said, I thumbed through them. They are about 400 pages, roughly, correct?
Right.
Yeah, and I thumbed through them just checking out random different facts. It is definitely worth picking them up. If you're a fan of The Twilight Zone or James Bond, I would second that notion from Steve to go and pick up a couple copies, if you will. So, Steve, thank you so very much for coming on. Really appreciate it. It's been fun. And when the new movie drops, I'll have to have you come back on, and we'll talk about the new movie and see what you think about it. How about that?
That'd be great. I would love to do that, John. That'd be great.
Excellent. Well, ladies and gentlemen, with that, I'm going to throw it to a quick break. And on the other side of the break, I will come back and wrap up the episode. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. My conversation with Steve Rubin, talking about his two encyclopedias covering James Bond and The Twilight Zone. I want to thank Steve for taking some time out of his busy schedule to sit down and chat with me. I would also like to thank him for the digital copies of his encyclopedias. That was really cool to have them and be able to thumb through them real quick. And let me just tell you right now, if you're a fan of either one of those franchises, you need to grab these encyclopedias. Seriously, they are world class. All right, well, that being said, it's time for me to let you know where you can get in touch with me if you have a question, comment, or whatnot about this episode, or quite frankly, any episode of the PVD cast. You can find me on Twitter. My personal Twitter handle is @PVDMVP. You can leave me a message over on the Facebook and Instagram feeds. Just look for @PVDcast. You can even shoot me an email if you like, johnorlando@pvdcast.com. And let me tell you where the PVDcast is available. Pretty much it's out there all over the place, all those major podcasting platforms. But also it's available at pvdcast.com, the online home of yours truly. And you can even hear it through a couple different live broadcasts through the week. Every Monday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I host a live broadcast of the current episode through the Facebook page. And that, again, is at PVDcast. And if you miss it on Monday, well, Tuesday nights, 7:30 Eastern Time, The Scene Snobs, a great podcasting network, well, they replay it through their Facebook page. Just go and look for at The Scene Snob. And I want to thank again all the fine folks over at The Scene Snobs Network for distributing out the PVDcast. And check out all the great podcasts they got in their catalog. Just look at www.thescenesnobs.com and see what they got. I'm sure they'll have something that will tickle your fancy, as the old saying goes. So with that then, ladies and gentlemen, I should start wrapping things up here. I thank you for listening, and I will chat at each and every one of you later. Stay righteous, stay independent, stay safe and healthy. Production of John Orlando Enterprises, LLC, copyright 2021.